This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number 26, 3 John, support of God's workers. 2 John, beware of false teachers.
Hi, welcome back as we continue our study in the general letters. Today we want to focus on two of John's letters, 3 John and 2 John. I do assume that John is writing these letters. It's the Apostle John. Would have been a cousin to Jesus. I tend to put the Johannine letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, towards the end of the first century, perhaps around 90 A.D. And so he's writing during a period of time where Domitian is governor, or Caesar, and over the Greco-Roman world. And he's writing to people in Asia Minor, the churches in Asia, the seven churches that I think would have been recipients of the Revelation, if John was indeed the author of Revelation. But I am assuming that these letters, 3rd, 2nd, and 1st John, are written by the Apostle John. And as always, I reserve the right to be wrong. But at this point in my life, that's where I'm at. Now, I'm going to start with 3rd John, because it's probably the least controversial letter, but yet it has a very significant message that I sometimes think gets lost within our evangelical churches. So I'm going to begin with 3 John, and then we will move to 2 John as we pave our way to 1 John. So 3 John is a letter of commendation. We talked about the different types of letters that exist in my session on the genre of the general letters. And I do see John, this letter, 3 John, as being a letter of commendation written to an individual whose name was Gaius. And John identifies himself as the elder, and he is addressing this letter to Gaius on behalf of several itinerant ministers of the gospel. He moves from this commendation to praise Gaius for his hospitality. And then eventually the author commends these same itinerant preachers and others as people worthy of further support, further hospitality. And the reason, primarily, is because of they are totally dependent on believers for their support. John is going to commend a man by the name of Demetrius for consideration of support, and hence the reason why this is a letter of commendation. So they seem to be the framework for this letter. There is one section where he does name an individual for his inability and unwillingness to support God's workers. But bottom line, verse 8, the author makes it perfectly clear that hospitality is expected from all believers and is supposed to be extended to anyone who is in a vocational call to preach and teach the message of Jesus. So that's pretty much the background for 3 John. Let's go ahead and read and work our way through 3 John in verses and begin with this opening salutation in the first four verses. He writes from the elder, he's the sender, to Gaius, he's the recipient And he's described as my dear brother, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that all may go well with you, and that you may be in good health, just as it is well with your soul. So let's stop there. Those first two verses, again, it's a typical greeting. And he has a prayer of joy about Gaius and his faithfulness. He expresses the fact that he loves Gaius in truth. Now, this word truth is going to have several different meanings, and context is going to mean anything, several things. Here, I think truth has the idea of in the truth of God's word. He loves them because of the shared truth that they share and they believe. And he prays a certain prayer, and this, to me, this is a pretty significant prayer that he's praying. He says, I pray it may go well with you and that you may be in good health, just as it is well with your soul. And it's almost as though he's saying, I pray that your spiritual well-being may be mirrored in your physical health. What an awesome thought. It raises the question, how is our spiritual health? Would we want somebody praying that for you, that our spiritual health would be a reflection of our physical health? But at any rate, John really values the spiritual health of this individual named Gaius. And then he gives the reason here, a reason for this praise. The basis for this elder's joy is found in that, for I rejoiced greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth. So the basis for this joy that he has is what has been testified on his behalf. Believers have come to John and testified to your truth. Now this is no longer just content, but it's truth in action. Faith works. Faith in action. And so truth is being manifested and lived out. And these brothers have come and told John about how he lives out the truth, just as you're living according to the truth. So you see this parallel going on. I have no greater joy than this, to hear that my children are living according to the truth. Truth, it lived out. Faith works. So we have this opening salutation that speaks about a man who lives out the truth of the gospel. Then our author, in verses 5 through 12, gives an expectation to all Christians, that all Christians are supposed to support God's workers. So in verses 5 through 8, while John is commending Gaius about his faithful support of servants, he exhorts him to lavish support on workers because their livelihood depends on God's people. Listen as we read. Dear friend, you demonstrate faithfulness by whatever you do for the brothers, even though they are strangers. So even though he doesn't know these individuals, he has demonstrated his faithfulness. He's lived out this truth. He's been faithful in living out this truth, even though he hasn't known them very well or at all. They have testified of your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. So here we have a group of individuals that that apparently came to Gaius in the past. Gaius treated them with hospitality as servants of the Lord, and they in turn went back to their home church, and I suspect it's John's church, and they stood up and testified about Gaius and how he has been faithful in supporting them in their ministry. They have now since returned and are carrying this letter. And John is once again exhorting about or praising him for their testimony, but exhorting them, you would do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. So John is saying, what you have done, do it again. It's keep on keeping on. You've done something good in the past, and I'm encouraging you to do it again, but you know, don't hold them up. You know, send them on their way. And when we think about supporting in this time of the world, or this time of time period, you know, we think of food and clothing, but it involved much more. It was food and clothing for what you need now, but even food and clothing that would carry you over to your next stop in order to do your ministry. When I think about how does this apply today, I think about, you know, it's not just a matter of providing food and clothing. It's a matter of providing a means to support a family, which involves life insurance, health insurance. I mean, what does it take this 21st century in order for a person of God, a vocational worker for God, to perform ministry? It encompasses a lot more than just giving food for the day. In much the same way in the ancient Near East, where it was food for the day and clothing, a place to stay, a roof over your head, but giving enough to carry them further on their journey. Today, what would that look like? And I think it's providing for a person for their needs to make a living. And it's supposed to be in a way worthy of God, in a manner that is worthy of God. How would you treat God if he came to your home, or he attended your church or served in your church? How would you, what package would you give God? In a manner worthy of God. It's not the minimalist idea. Well, what can we get away with? What's the bare minimum? I've been in situations where I've been hired, and well, this is a new position, and you know, we're really not sure how we can. What's the bare minimum you need to be able to make it? And so that approach has been given, or another approach is, well, we're going to pay you a median salary. You know, we've got this broad package, and we're going to average it out, and we're just going to give you the middle of the road package. Let's see, what's the text say? Send them on their way with a medium package, the average, or send them on their way just to barely make their bills and pay their bills. That's not what this passage says. It's not what this passage says. And too many men and women today serving as pastors in churches, serving in academic institutions, collect what are eligible for food stamps. Verse 7 tells us, for they have gone forth on behalf of the name. They have gone forth on behalf of Jesus, accepting nothing from pagans, nothing from those who don't know Jesus as their personal Savior. They go out in God's name. There's no pagan support. They're totally dependent on believers. So John draws this conclusion. Therefore, we ought. It doesn't say, therefore, perhaps, or therefore, if we have it in the budget. No, therefore, we ought to support such people so that we become co-workers in cooperation with the truth. Co-workers, and here, truth, I think, it now moves from just a content or content plus action, but here truth is referring to Jesus. Jesus is the truth. I am the way, the truth, and the light. So we become co-workers in cooperation with Jesus, who is the truth. So, therefore, we ought to support workers. There is this, this commending Gaius for his faithfulness. His expectation, his exhortation to lavish support upon the workers because their livelihood depends on godly people to support them. And the expectation gets expanded to include all believers. All believers are supposed to extend support to God's vocationally called in a manner worthy of God. Then he moves to verses 9 through 10, and he's going to talk about an uncooperative Christian with regards to this issue. He expresses, to some extent, alarm over his uncooperativeness. I refer to him, I pronounce his name as Diotrephes. Some will say Diophantus. But I say Diotrephes, same guy. In verses 9 to 10, John expresses concern over Diotrephes' rejection of the elders' authority and refusal to support God's workers. Let's look at verses 9 and 10. I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept us. Therefore, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds he is doing, the bringing of unjustified charges against us with evil words. And I'll just stop there. So here we have John having written something to a church where Diotrephes attends. I suspect that in striving to reconstruct how this letter fits some of these situations, I suspect what happened was this group of itinerant ministers that typically would carry a letter with them went to Diotrephes' church, and Diotrephes refused to offer support. So what's a worker to do? I think that the way in which John mentions Diotrephes' name seems to indicate that Gaius knows who he is and is aware of his church. And so what may have happened is that this group of itinerant missionaries that were initially sent to the church of Diotrephes' church with the letter, he disregarded the letter, and those itinerant missionaries sought another church, and they went to Gaius' church, and Gaius provided the support. And so in their return home, John has been informed of Diotrephes' action and informed of Gaius' faithfulness in providing for these workers who were strangers to him. That's what I think's happened. So, and apparently, John knows how Diotrephes felt about this letter because he said he loves to be first, so he's apparently he's an arrogant leader. I mean, that's what that kind of conveys. And he doesn't acknowledge us. In other words, the very fact that he rejected a letter that he wrote, John wrote, is a sign of rejection. He has rejected us. Therefore, if I come, I'm going to call attention to his deeds. I'm going to call attention to what he's done. He has been inhospitable. He's rejected a letter of commendation. these itinerant letter missionaries had to go someplace else to get their support. He's going to bring these things up. And bringing up the bringing up of unjustified charges against us with evil words. And not being content with that, he not only refuses to welcome the brothers himself, but he hinders the people who want to. So it's not enough that he won't support them. Anyone who desires to come alongside and support them, he hinders them. And if they do happen to support the itinerant missionaries, he throws them out. He expels them from the church. Dear friend, don't imitate what is bad, but imitate that which is good. So what is bad? I think this is a reference to Diotrephes. Don't imitate him, but imitate what is good. And I think where he's going, he's going to point to Demetrius in the next verse. The one who does good is of God. The one who does bad has not seen God. Now we need to put those two phrases in our pipe and smoke them a little bit. Let's smoke on these two statements. The one who does good is of God. This is another way of saying he has God. He knows God. He has a relationship with God. But the one who does what is bad hasn't seen God. That's John's way of saying he doesn't know God. He has no relationship with God. He isn't a follower of Jesus. That's pretty harsh. He recognizes Gaius as a person who lives the truth. Diotrephes has demonstrated the fact he doesn't live the truth, therefore he has no truth. He doesn't know the truth. Show me your faith without works, James says. Remember, James and John are brothers. Cousins of Jesus. Now let's talk about Demetrius. And this is where this letter becomes a letter of commendation. Demetrius has been testified to all, even by the truth itself. So what he's doing is saying, Demetrius is a good man. He is a man that has been testified by all, that's including us, and by the truth itself. In other words, he too lives out the truth. We also testify to him, and you know what? You can count on our testimony. You know that our testimony is true. So here in verses 11 and 12, he is arranging for the sponsorship of Demetrius. And then finally, we have John's closing salutation, verses 13 through 15. And the basis of John ending this letter is found in his expression and need to discuss the issue of supporting God's servants and perhaps other masters in more detail. He wants to talk about this in a little bit more detail, but he doesn't want to do it right now. I have many things to write to you about this issue, I think, filling in the blank. But I don't want to write to you with pen and ink, but I hope to see you right away, and we will speak face to face. Peace be with you. The friends here greet you. Greet the friends there by name. So it seems that John knows not just Gaius, but the people that attend his church and offers this greeting or this final salutation. I think this, I want to say something about letters of recommendation. You know, oftentimes I get letters of recommendation I'm asked to write letters of recommendation. And I know as a faculty member, students would ask me if I would write a letter of recommendation for them, and I'd always respond to every student the exact same way. I need to know you a little bit more than just taking me for a single class. I only get to know you in a class setting, and so my letter of recommendation would be very minimal because I don't know very much about you. However, if you really would like to have a letter of recommendation written by me, it would be helpful for you to take more than just one class with me, and that perhaps maybe we go out to lunch, or maybe we go out to dinner, or we hang out together so I can get to know you. Maybe even invite me to a Sunday school class you're teaching so I can see, you know, how you you teach. And if you really want me to write a letter of recommendation, prepare those you wish to write this letter, prepare them for you for it. And because if I only have you for 1 year, I only know you for 1 year, and they ask you, how long have you known the referent? And I say, 1 year. Right away, I've disqualified myself as being a very valued recommender for anyone. Really, a letter of recommendation should be written by someone that knows you for a rather long period of time in different situations for it to be commendable or worthy of anything. I think John is exemplifying a letter written for somebody that he knows. And he can say, you know me. I'm not going to recommend somebody that isn't up for the task. It's going to be the same for me. I won't recommend anyone for a position if I don't know them. And so that's important to keep in mind when it comes to looking for people to write letters of recommendation. Now, 2 John is a little bit different. 2 John, again, is a typical letter, Greco-Roman letter that has three parts, you know, opening salutation, body, closing salutation, just like 3 John had. But in this letter, the elder or John is concerned about false teaching. So whereas in the first letter it was written to Gaius, praising him for his willingness and the manner in which he supported Christian workers, this letter he is writing not to a single individual, but to a group of individuals in a church. And he's writing to them in this church because of false teaching. And we'll see what that false teaching is as we move into this letter. So let's begin by looking at verses 1 through 3. And we have John writing, and he says, from the elder, from John, to an elect lady and her children. Now, some might see this as an elect lady as being a person and her children being in their household. However, this is also another way of referring to and speaking of a church. And the children are the people in the church. So I see this as more of a reference to not an individual, and not a person who's called the Electra, as though that's her name, but actually a church and the children are the people that are in this church, attending this church. There are numerous reasons that you could give for this, but we'll let you investigate commentaries and track that down. There are good people that actually see this as being written to a woman and her children. I think, if I remember correctly, Chuck Swindoll holds that position. I happen to think that John is actually writing to a church here, though. He says, their people, this church, are people that I love, and not I alone, but all those who know the truth. So all those who share in this truth about Jesus, and so here truth is cognitive truth, I love you in the truth. I love you in Jesus, who is our Messiah, who came, died, and was resurrected. I love you in that truth, in that gospel truth, and not just I, but all those who know this gospel truth. And here's the reason. Because the truth resides in us and will be with us forever. It's part of who we are. And then he has the salutation. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus, who is the Christ, the Son of the Father, in truth and in love. From here, John moves into the body of his letter, and here the elder's joy and encouragement is identified and expressed in a way that encourages this church to live the truth. He writes, "But now I ask you, lady, not as if I were waiting or writing a new command, but the one we have had from the beginning, namely that we love one another. Now this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you've heard from the beginning, thus you should walk in it." So here we have John expressing his joy and encouraging this church to live according to the truth or according to a commandment. And he makes it really clear that this is not a commandment that's new. This is a command, this is an expectation that they've had from the beginning, that from the very beginning that they've heard the gospel message. This isn't a reference to the beginning of Jesus' ministry. It's the beginning that they heard the truth, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And so John is concerned about the way in which this church is interrelating with one another. Now this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. Now, the commandments here, I think, is a reference to the fact that God says the greatest commandments are these: love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. They're the plural form of commandments. And then he says, this is the commandment, just as you've heard from the beginning, thus you should walk in it. Then he moves to a warning about false teachers. And this is divided into two sections. First, there's the presence and danger of false teachers. And then there are specific instructions on how to deal with their threat. So the danger of false teachers is found in verses 7 to 8, where we read, "For many deceivers have gone out into the world, people who do not confess Jesus as the Christ coming in the flesh." So let me stop there. So John is recognizing that there have been false teachers in the church that have gone out from them. They were members of the church. They were involved in the church. They were people knew them. And he's saying there's been some people that have left the church. And there's certain characteristics about these people. They don't confess Jesus. But he specifies exactly what it is that they don't confess about Jesus. Are you ready? They do not confess Jesus as the Messiah. But not just that Jesus was Messiah, but he was Jesus as Messiah who came in the flesh. That is, he was a person. He was human. Now, whether John is combating this idea that Jesus was just a spiritual being and not a physical being, as though he's some type of Gnosticism, I don't know. That has been suggested. But the thing I want to emphasize is that John finds it really important that part of what we are expected to confess is he's the Messiah and he was human. Now, for many of us in our evangelical circles, we emphasize deity so much, I think we forget the fact that he was human. We don't emphasize his incarnation or his humanity. So if I were to talk about Jesus, we seldom will talk about and focus on the fact that he was a man. It's all about the fact that he is a divine son. In that fact, we talk about systematic theology. We talk about Jesus as the Son of God. If I were to ask you, if I say to you, Jesus is the Son of God, what will you tell me? Oh, it's Jesus is God. That phrase is lumped and equated with Jesus being God. Now, before I say anything else, I want you to repeat after me, okay? Dr. Bateman believes in the deity of Jesus. Okay, everybody join with me and say it as you're sitting in the privacy of your home. And even though you know you may feel silly, I want you to say, Dr. Bateman believes in the deity of Jesus. Okay? So when I say to you the fact that Son of God may not mean deity, if you see it in a particular text of Scripture, don't jump on me. I think in Mark, Jesus is referred to as Son of God, and I think Son of God is just another title for his messianism. Jesus is declared by God, you are my son. Today I fathered you. Has nothing to do with deity. Has everything to do with his messiahship, being God's man, sent to carry out God's plan to reestablish kingdom and redeem a people to enter into that kingdom. So it really is important that we recognize that Jesus was human. And even though we tried, even though at times, I think we overemphasize his deity at his humanity, we need to be mindful that he really was human. And people in this situation were denying the humanity of Jesus and refusing to see Jesus as Messiah. Listen to what John says about such a person. This person's a deceiver. He's an antichrist. Now, this isn't the antichrist that's going to come at the end of the world, but it's just someone who's against Messiah. It's someone against Messiah. And then he says this, watch out. Watch out so that you do not lose the things we have worked for, but receive a full reward. So what he's talking about is in these verses, he's moving to discussing how to deal with false teachers. And the first thing he wants them to do is be careful, beware, watch out for them. And it's a two-pronged strategy with dealing with these people who appear to have infiltrated the church. The first thing has to deal, he wants them to watch out to be aware of their existence so that you don't lose the things we've worked for. In other words, don't let them in. And people that have come to know Jesus, they become targets to be led astray. So let's not lose the things we've worked for. There are people that we are going out into the world to share about Jesus, that he's the Messiah, that he came in the flesh, and he came in order to enable us to enter in God's kingdom. But if you let these false teachers in, they may lead these converts astray, and then we lose that reward. I think that reward here, full reward, are people that we have ministered with and led to Jesus in our lifetime. I don't think this is a reference to crown. I think this is a reference to people. And I think sometimes we overplay crowns as being something literal. I think our real reward are going to be the people that we have ministered to, we've invested in, people that we've led to Jesus, people that that know Jesus as Messiah, and you've taught them in Sunday school class, people that you have supported in missions to go out, and people come to know Christ through their work. You have taken a part in that ministry. They are our reward. People are our reward. And we don't want to jeopardize our reward by allowing false teachers to come in and lead them astray. If believers aren't careful, they could be led astray. People that we invest our lives in can be led astray, and we lose that eschatological, that future reward that awaits us, and it harms our relationship with God. Now John, in verses 10 to 11, gives us instructions on how to deal with false teachers. Verse 10 says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, what teaching? What teaching is he talking about? It's clearly stated that Jesus is the Christ and that Jesus was human. For John, these are the two main prongs of teaching. If anyone does not believe that Jesus is human and does not believe that Jesus is the Christ, this is what he says. Don't receive them into your house. Now, I think at this point, John is talking about a house as in the sense of a house church. Don't receive them into your church, not into necessarily your own home. And then it says, don't give them any greeting. This kind of seems kind of harsh. I don't think he's saying don't say howdy. Don't even say hello to them. I think what he's doing is he's just don't get overly familiar with them. Don't welcome them into your ministry in a sense that they would become seen as partners with you in ministry. Because the person who gives him a greeting shares in his evil deeds. Now, I want to be careful about how we talk about this. Because it was interesting when I am a graduate of Cairn University. But when I went to Cairn University, and resides in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, when I began at that school, it was called Philadelphia College of the Bible, and they met in downtown Philly before they moved to Langhorne. And I went to school with a fella who's a good friend of mine, still is a good friend of mine, though we don't see each other as often as we used to because I'm in Indiana and he still is in South Jersey. We planted a church together. He was the church planner, and I kind of was tagging along, and I had my ministry, a coffee house ministry in in East Camden, but he was planting a church in Washington Township in South Jersey, and we would oftentimes get together. I'd attend his Bible study with this group of people, and his church eventually grew large enough to build a building. In time, I went on to accept a youth pastor position in Chester, Pennsylvania. And at the time, they were part of the United Presbyterian Churches. Okay? I was hired because I held to the inerrancy of Scripture. They had turned down. I'm a 4-year Bible college grad, and with a major in Bible, minor in pastoral studies, liberal arts degree with a major in Bible, minor in pastoral studies, and they hired me over seminary graduates from Presbyterian schools because of my stance on Scripture. What a great group of people. Turned out to be one of the best church situations I've ever been in. Loved that group of folks. And the only regret was I was only there for a short period of time before I went to Dallas Theological Seminary for further training. But to get to my point, yeah, what is your point? Well, this friend of mine in South Jersey, I had made a suggestion to him that maybe we could do a joint youth group event. Maybe we can, you know, because he didn't have a lot of young people. My group was a little larger, but we could do something together and have this camaraderie between churches. And he said to me, well, Herb, I don't think that would be good because I don't want my ministry to be tainted by the fact that you are at such and such a church. Now, that's not what we're talking about here. That is ecclesiastical separation, I think. I'm a brother in Jesus. I profess Jesus to be my Messiah. I believed he came in the flesh. He was exalted to God in the heavens. He sits at the right hand of God. He is God's appointed servant. And my friend knew that about me. And that church believed those very same things. But because they're a Presbyterian domination, that became a reason not to fellowship with me or my youth group, and because of negative perceptions that he had about the USA Presbyterian Church. That's not what this passage is about. This passage is about someone or a group of people who have rejected Jesus as Messiah and rejected that he came in the flesh. That's what this passage is about. So if we have a church, you know, a church who is a church in name only. My wife tells me when she went to a church in Allentown when she was growing up, and she didn't grow up in a Christian home, by the way. They had, their youth group had seances in the church basement. Now that type of church we wouldn't have fellowship with, that group of people. Because the gospel wasn't taught. My wife did not know about Jesus. She came to know Jesus through a Billy Graham crusade that she was listening to on television. We don't participate with churches that deny fundamental doctrines of our faith. That's what this passage is about. Once again, John closes this letter in a typical manner, typical of a Greco-Roman world. Though I have many other things to write to you, I do not want to do so with paper and ink. But I hope to come and visit you and speak to you face to face so that our joy may be complete. He's looking forward to meeting with this church and having a joyful time of reacquainting. The children of your Lex sister greet you. Here's the reason why I think this is a church. The children of your Lex sister, a sister church, greet you. How does this letter begin? To an elect lady and her children. Whereas he starts this letter with this terminology, this language that seems to indicate a church, he closes this letter, the children of your elect sister greet you. So he's using these terms become metaphor for community of believers. All right, so there we go. We've got two letters written by John. The first, which in our Bibles is 3 John, is a letter of commendation that focuses on accommodating a vocational leader for Jesus and how it is that as believers we are to support vocational leaders in a manner worthy of God. And then the second letter, 2 John, is addressing the issue of false teachers. A warning against false teachers, and a proposed action plan to avoid false teachers. Now, when we come back, we're going to pick up with 1 John, and we're going to begin our study in 1 John. But in the meantime, I trust that you will have a great day, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dr. Herb Bateman in his instruction on the general letters. This is session number 26, 3 John, support of God's workers. 2 John, beware of false teachers.